Hey everyone, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems and BikeJames.com, and welcome to a special Bike James podcast. This is a special podcast for me because I am going to be talking about a concept, the riding for a lifetime concept, something that I introduced recently with a new camp that I was having. I sold it out in just a few days and had a ton of interest from people saying that they wanted more info on future camps and also just, you know, advice on this riding for a lifetime concept. And so I realized that there were a lot of riders out there who were interested in learning more about how to sustain riding, you know, as long as you can, right? Like, no one wants to have to quit riding because of age or injury, or you just see your performance decline to the point that it's no fun anymore. So you want to be able to try to ride better, not only today and tomorrow, but for years and years and years to come. And so eventually a lot of us realize that the strategies and tactics that we've been told and have been using in the past are not sustainable. Right? They're just not sustainable. We end up with injuries. We end up with just all sorts of problems from doing the things that we've been told to do by the fitness media and the cycling media. And so there's a disconnect between what we need to do to sustain riding at a relatively high level for a long period of time and what you need to do to try to improve your performance over a short period of time. And a lot of this confusion comes because the media, again, both in the fitness media in general and also in the cycling industry in particular, they are focused a lot on what the pros do. And then they also look at studies, but these studies tend to be short-term studies. And so both of these lead to problems in trying to just, you know, figure out like, well, what's the best thing to do for sustainable training. Now here's why, because the pros, they break down, right? So the dirty little secret is that where good sport begins, good health ends. That professionals in any sport, to do what they do to their bodies, to get them to perform at the levels that they do, is not healthy. And they break down. They are in pain while they're competing. And when they're done competing, they are dealing with a lifetime of problems that are a result of the things they did to their body to get it to the point that they needed to perform at that level. Now, again, there's all sorts of examples in countless sports, right? You got Tiger Woods, who's got a knee that he's dealing with from playing golf. You had Peyton Manning, who is a quarterback that had to quit because of neck injuries and stuff. And so there are countless examples of both high profile athletes and then just every day, just your regular run of the mill athletes that when you take something to a really high level, especially if you get to a professional level, that you are doing things to your body that are not sustainable and they do cause short-term and long-term problems. But of course, if you're a professional athlete and you're paying your bills based on your performance, then that's worth it, right? Like you can look back and yeah, you've blown out your knee and your lower back is jacked for the rest of your life, but man, it was worth it, right? Like you made money. There was glory and all these other things involved. That is not the case for the vast majority of us, right? Like pretty much everybody listening to this podcast, that's not your reality. You're not getting paid based on how well you ride. So for you, you have a different goal. You're not willing to sacrifice your future health for these short-term gains. But the pros are. The pros are willing to sacrifice their long-term health for these short-term gains because the benefit outweighs the cost. But that's not the same. That math doesn't work the same for everybody. But that is the way that the cycling media portrays it. That if this is what the pros are doing to get their bodies into shape to perform at the highest levels, then this is what you want to be doing too. And so the high intensity, usually high volume, movement specific training programs that the pros use get passed on to your everyday rider, and then they try them and break down doing them and then wonder, okay, what's going on here? This doesn't work, right? So again, I've been there both with strength training and with endurance training, both as a runner and a cyclist. And so I've seen and experienced firsthand both when it's okay to do this, because I've worked with some of the best riders in the world. Like, I was Aaron Gwynn's original strength coach. I worked with the Yeti World Cup team. I've worked with several, you know, World Cup level riders and teams. And so I know that there is a time and a place for doing things that are going to cause problems, that especially if they're left unchecked, will start to cause short-term and long-term problems. But you got to weigh that risk to benefit ratio. And if the math works out, then you go for it. But that math is different for everyone. And so again, if you're a World Cup racer and we're trying to get you, you know, onto the podium for the first time, then that's a much different risk to benefit math than if you are a, you know, 45-year-old father of two who just wants to be able to, you know, ride good and play with his kids, right? Like, that's a totally different goals, different math that's going to be involved, all of that. And so, you know, if you don't realize that and you don't know that, then it's very easy to get influenced by these things that you see. And again, the other thing that compounds this problem is we live in this Instagram age. It's all about doing it for the gram. And so you see professional riders posting stuff on their Instagram as far as training goes. Man, they're not posting the boring stuff. They're posting this high intensity crap. And then what's even worse is you get coaches, which is even worse, that fall for this. So you get these strength coaches that know, like, oh man, this stuff plays well, and people, it feeds their ego. So if I got my athletes doing these crazy plyometrics and these box jumps and stuff, that, and then I get a video of it and then they post it, that you know, they're going to get a bunch of likes and people liking that. So that's going to feed their ego and it's going to feed my ego, because everybody's going to be like, oh, you know, what a great trainer. I'm going to follow him and then watch all these other athletes he's got doing asinine bullshit that just because it looks good on Instagram, but is unsustainable. And the risk to benefit ratio is ridiculous, right? Like, I mean, somebody posted a video, the pink bike, which is a terrible media outlet for mountain biking, by the way, but that'll be a subject for another podcast. But they posted something on a social media roundup of what professional riders were doing. And, you know, it's amazing to me, like, how many professional riders, their trainers have them doing box jumps. Like, and not just like regular box jumps, but box jumps where you're really pushing the edge, like 100%. How high can you go? And somebody posted a video of somebody missing a jump and falling on their tailbone and falling on their butt. And this girl could have gotten hurt, right? Like, this very easily could have broken your tailbone. You very easily can get hurt doing this. Or you slip and you hit your shins and then you're out. And it's like, there's no excuse. Like, everybody's laughing because she was okay, right? Like that. And it's like, oh, ha, ha, it's funny. It's like, dude, that's not funny. And the fact that, like, oh man, like, that they would post that and think that it was funny, like, that should be embarrassing for the trainer. And that the athlete should be like, what the hell, man? Like, why are you putting me at risk in the gym over this? Like, so that you can video it and for, like, what's going on here? And so again, if you're gonna do box jumps, that's fine. But, like, you, I mean, good training's about learning, right? Like, it's just a little side rant. But in the gym, you should be building your physical capacities, not testing your physical capacities. And so you should not be doing 100% box jumps. There's no reason to be doing 100% box jumps. Your box jump should be like 80% max, right? Like, you should know for sure you're making that. Obviously mistakes happen, but just way too often I see box jumps in particular are getting super popular, with people just seeing, like, how high can I jump? Because you see these NFL athletes, like, piling these things up higher than their head and they're jumping on them. Like, these people are freaks. Yeah, that looks freaking awesome. It's super cool to watch. But it leads to this culture of doing things that are unsustainable and are actually potentially, like, problematic in the short term as well. Like, getting injured while training is never excusable. And so you should never be doing something, either with your own training or if you're a coach, like, with your athletes, that exposes them to any sort of legitimate injury risk in the gym, right? Like, your job is to be enhancing what they do so that they can get out and do more of their sport, not putting what you're doing front and center and saying, like, injury risk in this is okay because this is so freaking important that it even kind of outweighs your sport itself. And that's the crazy ego that a lot of coaches get that you got to watch, man. There's a lot of coaches out there, and I'll be honest with you, I used to be one of them. I will totally admit that I used to be one of them that truly believed that me as a strength coach, as me as a strength and conditioning coach, that what I was having the athletes do was the most important thing, even more important on some level than riding their bike. And, you know, that was a ridiculous mindset to have. And so, but I, you notice, man, like my programs had to change and my whole mindset had to change once I changed that attitude. And so, again, my point is that it's so dangerous to look at what the pros are doing and then what the cycling media is portraying as far as like, this is what training for cycling and mountain biking should be, because it's like I said, they're not projecting the truth, both short term and the long term ramifications. So again, like for the average rider, that's just, it's not a good risk to benefit math doing those high intensity, unsustainable training tactics. And then the other problem I touched on was relying too heavily on studies. Because again, you want to use studies as signposts, but they're not law, right? Like, so you, and the reason is that a lot of these studies are done on a very short-term basis. So you're talking like 4, 6, maybe 8 weeks long. Like the vast majority of studies are that long. And there's a big difference between, well, what happened in 6 weeks and what's going to happen in 6 months and what's going to happen in 6 years, right? Like just doing the same thing over and over and over again is one, you reach a point of diminishing returns where you stop seeing the same results. Like, yeah, some studies showed that this specific training method produced these great results over 6 to 8 weeks, but that doesn't mean that the gains are going to stay the same for the next 6 to 8 years. And also, what is the negative side effects of this? And how does that start to add up on a long enough timeline, right? Like everybody's survivability rate drops to zero. And on a long enough timeline, your mistakes catch up to you with this stuff. Like not really mistakes, but everything has a risk to benefit ratio. There's no perfect program out there. There's no perfect training strategy out there. And so, again, like understanding that these short-term studies are good to look at to get ideas, but that if you're not taking into account that they may be doing things in these short-term studies that if you do over the long term, over a long enough period of time, may start to have negative consequences, again, leads to less than optimal decisions for riders when they're trying to decide, how am I going to approach mountain biking and training for mountain biking to make it sustainable? Again, this isn't just in the gym, right? This is also riding strategies. Like, you know, both how often you're riding, how long you're riding, what you're doing during your rides. These are also things that get misrepresented and misportrayed in the cycling media as far as like what the pros are doing and what their approach is. And so it can lead to some confusion for riders as well. And so that's, you know, I guess really kind of where the problem stems from as far as I see it. And then, you know, where I think that the riding for a lifetime concept, why it kind of struck a chord with people is because they realize on some level that this is what's going on, right? Like they've done this stuff and they realize it's not sustainable, you know, or they're starting to break down, they're starting to accrue these injuries, and they're like, man, what do I do to keep this from just continuing to progress and get worse and worse and worse? And so that's what this is all about. Now, here's the dirty little secret though. Is that longevity is really one of the best things you can do for your performance enhancement, right? Like if you're hurt, it doesn't matter how fit you are. So this, like the idea that following the concepts from the riding for a lifetime, the riding for a lifetime concept and following strategies that are focused on sustainability first and performance enhancement second, that this is going to lead to some giant decrease in your performance and you're just going to be a second rate rider. Because some people, like the idea, like, man, I'd rather burn, you know, be a bright, bright flash for a short period of time than just suck for a long period of time. So, but the reality is that your longevity is the best thing, right? If you ride on a consistent basis for 5, 10, 15 years, man, you can't help but be pretty good, right? If you've been consistent with it. So if you keep getting hurt, either because you're not doing stuff to offset what riding's doing to you and you just have unsustainable riding strategies, or you're trying to do some fitness training and you've got unsustainable fitness training and you keep getting hurt doing that. Like if you have a pattern of getting hurt on a regular or semi-regular basis, like you're not going to progress as fast as someone who is able to train that whole time with fewer injuries. And so even if you're focused more on short-term performance enhancement and they're focused more on sustainable training, at the end of like 5, 10, 15 years, all of those gaps in your training are going to hold you back more than all of that high intensity training pushed you forward. And especially compared to the rider who is sustainable. So it is the rabbit and the hare, right? Like the old, the kids, fairy tale there or whatever. What is that? Aesop's Fable, or I forget what the hell that came from. But yeah, the tortoise and the hare, that, you know, going fast may be great for the short term, but slow and steady will win that race. And that is the I guess really the thing. I wish we did a better job of telling mountain bikers when they came in. Like I've been doing a lot of Brazilian jiu-jitsu for the last 7+ years. And that's one thing I think that jiu-jitsu does really well that I wish mountain biking would do a better job of, is that when you come in, you're told, man, it's going to be like, you know, it's 10 years to get a black belt. Like it's 10 years to be an expert at this. It's going to be like 5+ years until you feel, you know, pretty competent at it. Like it's going to be a year or two until you feel like you even know what the hell's going on. Right now, that sets people up to relax and enjoy the journey and not feel the need to search for these short-term performance enhancement things, because they realize this is a marathon. This is a long-term thing that I'm getting into. But you look at mountain bikers, when they get into mountain biking, there it's the exact opposite. Like, man, like if you're not, you know, it's just, it's crazy the expectations that we put on people and then they put on themselves, as far as like, if you've been riding for like 6 months to a year and you're still struggling in some way, like, man, something's wrong, right? You just need to be working harder, and you know, something's obviously wrong. And it's like, no, nothing's wrong. You should still suck after a year of riding. Like that's totally normal. Like that's totally normal. Like it just keep on sucking, because eventually, like sucking at something is the first step towards being kind of good at something. And so just accept that you're going to suck for a little while. And it makes the journey just so much more enjoyable and less intense, especially in the beginning. And so, you know, if riders coming in, especially if you're coming into riding and you're already in, you know, you're not a spring chicken anymore. You're in your late 30s, 40s, 50s. Like just know, you need to just settle in for the ride, right? Like it's going to be years until you feel that you've got a handle on what's going on the trail and feeling really confident, and that's fine. So that'll help you avoid these short-term fixes that, you know, like clipless pedals are a perfect example, right? Like if you just spent the time on flats, you would become an amazing rider on flats. But if someone is still like struggling with their pedal stroke after like a few weeks, then everyone, you know, the common thing is, oh, well, you know, you need to clipless pedals because that'll make you more efficient and blah, 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 and all this other nonsense. But really at the heart of it is this attitude that we have that people shouldn't struggle. That if you struggle, that's a sign that there's something wrong and you're not doing something right and you need to be working hard to fix it. And yes, that is part of it, but there's also just time. Like there's just time on the trail. Like there's nothing that's going to substitute for time on the trail. No amount of hard work, no amount of focus, no amount of all that other stuff is going to be a substitute for time on the trail. And so you need both. You need both. But just, you know, like I said, it's the time on the trail is what you're trying to focus on getting, because that's the best thing you can do to enhance your performance. And that's what we love to do. And so that's the whole point of this, is how do I do this for as much as possible, for as long as possible, and make it as enjoyable as possible? Because that's the other thing, is who wants to ride if you're hurting? Right? Like if you're hurting during a ride or after a ride, like that is not fun. Okay, and there's a lot of riders who end up quitting riding and cutting back on riding because riding hurts. And so, again, like it needs to be enjoyable. How do we do this? So anyways, that is the idea. Now, I want to go over the three pillars of this riding for a lifetime concept and just touch on them briefly. And again, the idea is I just kind of want to put these things in your head, get you thinking about them, because I'm going to be doing a lot more with this in the future, you know, camps and workshops. I got a program I'm working on, got all sorts of cool things in mind to help riders with this concept, because I think it's super important. It's a huge glaring hole in the cycling world and the training world, because if you look at all the websites out there, you know, Training Peaks, or I don't even know what another popular one is, right? Like in the road riding world, you got Sufferfest, and like, you know, all these other things that they're not focused on sustainable training practices, right? Like they're focused on short-term performance enhancement. It's like, okay, here's a program to help you with your enduro series this year. Okay, well, that's great, but what is going on like for the long term with this, right? And so there is a hole in the cycling world for helping riders with this, that if you are concerned with sustainable training and sustainable riding tactics, that where do you go to get that information? And right now, Bike James is really the best place, because that's really been behind a lot of what I've been doing over the last few years. Like, it's all kind of crystallized into this riding for a lifetime concept. But if you go back and you look at a lot of the things that I've been talking about and a lot of the training tools and a lot of the concepts that I've been using for the last 2+ years, you'll see that they fit within this riding for a lifetime concept. Because again, like, this is coming from my own journey personally. I mean, I've been working out for 30 years. I started when I was a teenager. So 30 years of strength training, I mean, pretty much nonstop. I've never really taken a long period of time off from strength training. I've been 20 years as a professional trainer, and 15+ years of that focused on mountain bikers. And so my own journey coupled with this other experience is what has led me down the path that's kind of brought me to this point, and why I want to share these things with other riders, because I know that there's something here that can help you as well, because this stuff has definitely helped me get past a point where I was wondering, like, you know, where am I going with riding, right? Like, what's going on here? Like, I'm starting to hurt more. I feel like my performance isn't where it needs to be. You know, the training programs that I'm using don't quite work the same. Like, what's going on here? Like, how do I make sure that this is something I can continue to do at an enjoyable level for the next, 30 years? I'm 44 this year. And it's like, man, I want to do this again until, like, as long as I can. So what are these pillars of this riding for a lifetime concept? So the three pillars, I'll tell you the three pillars, and then I'll touch on each one individually. The first one is sustainable fitness training. The second one is sustainable riding strategies. And the third one is efficient movement on and off the bike. Those three things form the foundation of this concept. And so the first one is sustainable fitness training. Now, one I've talked quite a bit about, just the high intensity training methods that the pros use and that, get studied and you see on Instagram, and how they're not really sustainable over the long term. And so the things that I have found to be sustainable stem from a concept that I created called the four quadrants of tension. And the four quadrants of tension, I have a post on this at bikejames.com that you can go and check out and get a little bit more information on it specifically. But I realized that it's not just the movement pattern that you are using. It's also the type of tension that you're putting on the movement pattern. Not all types of tension are the same. And so if you look at tension, they come in two different spectrums, right? So the first one is going to be compression versus leverage-based tension. Compression-based tension is where the load is in close to you, the load is equal. It's just about you overcoming the weight and gravity, the compression of these things to overcome the load. Now, on the other end of the spectrum is leverage-based loading. Now, leverage-based loading is the opposite of this. It's the weight is unbalanced, the load is out away from you, and so it's far more about stabilizing the load so that you can move with it than just overcoming the compression of the load. Excuse me. And so you can think about your compression-based strength as gym boy strength, right? The guy in the gym just doing deadlifts all the time, and your leverage-based strength as farm boy strength. The guy who's picking up and slinging bales of hay all the time. And, there's the old cliche saying, like, who would you rather have? Like, who would win a fight? Like, everyone knows that farm boy is more athletic, right? That if you're picking looking for athletes or there was going to be a fight, you'd put your money on farm boy. Well, this is why, because farm boy is always working on leverage-based tension and gym boy is always working on compression-based tension. Well, leverage-based tension is actually what we use more in real life than compression-based tension. And now, again, this is a spectrum, right? Like, you can have extremes on either end. And so, like, a good example for me to explain this would be to think about a squat. Okay, if you're doing a squat and you have a barbell, you're doing like a front squat. Okay, so you've got the barbell resting on your shoulders. So the weight's evenly loaded, it's in close, it's on you, and so it's all about you just overcoming the compression of the weight and gravity to move the load. Now, let's go from a front squat to a goblet squat. A goblet squat's a pretty popular exercise. You know, you can Google it and see what it is. But a goblet squat, excuse me, you're holding a kettlebell or a dumbbell in front of you, in front of your chest. So it's still pretty close in, but it's out away from you just a little bit more. And so now this is a little bit more leverage-based loading, right? You have to stabilize the load a little bit more than you do with a barbell that's resting on your shoulders or your back if you're doing a back squat. Now let's take this one step further and extend your arms out away from you. So now you're holding a kettlebell or a dumbbell, but you're holding it with your arms extended in front of you and you're doing a squat. And so now again, this is more leverage-based loading. The load is out away from you. If you were to just hold it in one hand so that you had it misloaded, you could use even less weight. So the more something gravitates towards leverage-based loading in general, the less weight you use because the more stability is a factor. And the more of a compression-based tension it is, the more weight you can move because it stabilizes itself. Stability is less of a factor for it. And so again, like you can look at machines. Using a machine like a Smith machine would be even more compression based than a free weight deadlift, right? Like a free weight deadlift would be a little bit more toward the leverage based end of the spectrum than using a machine would, because a machine, you have no stabilization that you have to do. At least with a barbell, there's a little stabilization you have to do. And so if you're, using a dumbbell or holding the weight out, even more stabilization. And so this spectrum of compression versus leverage based loading is really important to understand, because you can look at exercises and start to put them in a category as far as compression or leverage-based loading. And as mountain bikers, we require a lot of leverage-based tension on the bike. Most of what we're doing on the bike requires a high stability factor rather than a high compression factor. And so understanding this and using tools and strategies that train the leverage-based side of the spectrum help in a lot of different ways. Because the other thing is like I mentioned, the compression-based loading tends to use a lot more weight. Okay, and so you're putting more load on the joints. The loading is more directed to the joints, through the joints. And so with the leverage-based loading, you're using less load. And so there's just less overall stress on the system. And it's more about stabilizing. And so you're actually, it's less about the joints themselves than the fascial system and its ability to create stability through the system, rather than how much force and pressure can you run through your joints. And so that's why a lot of compression-based loading, like squats and benches and deadlifts, man, there's no one who does heavy squats and benches and deadlifts for a long period of time who doesn't end up torn up. Like high compression-based loading tears your body up. And it's not needed, right? Like, especially if you're in a sport like we are that doesn't use a lot of compression-based loading. If you're a power lifter, an Olympic weightlifter, even like sprinters, like that's more of a compression-based sport. But if you're in a leverage-based sport like we are, then doing a lot of compression-based training just breaks you down, and it's not actually as specific for your sport as it could be, right? So same movement pattern, but how are we loading the system? Are we using compression or are we using leverage-based loading? And leverage-based loading lends itself to sustainability better for several reasons. Now, the other side of this is also the movement speed. Right, looking at how fast you're moving. It's not just the type of tension, but it's also how fast you're moving, because that will affect the tension as well. So you have everything from isometric, where you're creating tension without moving at all the way to dynamic, like as fast as you can go. So again, thinking about a squat, for example. So an isometric squat would be, getting down into the bottom of a squat position and holding a weight, or even just for a lot of people, just holding a bodyweight squat is tough. And so just holding a bodyweight squat or adding some load and holding that for, 30 to 60 seconds. You could also do where you're driving into something that doesn't move. So using like a jiu-jitsu belt, something I use for my ramping isometric program, but something that you can put pressure into and isn't going to let you move. And so creating tension without actually moving, right? So the next thing would be super slow. So you're moving, but you're purposefully moving very slowly, very slowly. And so just keeping constant tension on the system. And then you move up one more notch up the spectrum, and now you're just moving at regular speed. So now I've got, I'm doing my squat, but I'm just doing normal speed, whatever, just my normal body, you know, my normal tempo would be. And then finally you have dynamic, where I'm trying to move as quickly as possible. So think about like a vertical jump. Okay, so again, like same movement pattern in the squat, but we can either do isometric, we can do super slow, we can do regular speed, and we can do dynamic. And all of those, like that, there's a spectrum, right? And things get, you know, where does one end and one begin? You know, you can debate, but the point is you have these different movement speeds, and you can't tell me that an isometric squat is going to deliver the same effect as a jump squat, as a vertical jump will. Same movement pattern, right? So if we're just saying, oh, I got to train a squat, I got to train my squat pattern. Okay, cool. What's the movement speed? The movement speed is also going to impact the results that you get. So is the type of tension. What are we doing, compression or leverage-based tension? Again, you can't tell me that a barbell squat and a squat where you're holding a weight in one arm out in front of you like are going to deliver the same net result to the system. It's going to deliver different results, even though it's the same movement pattern. So understanding how to look beyond just the movement patterns into the movement speed and the type of tension that you are putting on the system allows you to create better, more sustainable programs that actually target what we do on the bike more. And so again, when you put these things across each other, you form a quadrant where, you know, compression and leverage based is one line, and your isometric and dynamic is another, and you end up with four quadrants. You have dynamic compression, you have dynamic leverage, you have isometric compression, and you have isometric leverage. So these four areas are, you know, exercises, sports, everything will fall into one of these four categories. And again, you can use these to both create more specific programs. So one of the things that we need on our bike is actually a high degree of isometric strength. There's a lot of times when the majority of our body is actually creating tension without moving, right? So if you think about pedaling, for example, you're trying to create tension in the upper body and core without actually moving to create the platform for your legs. And so if you have super strong legs, but you don't have the isometric platform to use them on the bike, then you're not going to be able to use them as effectively. And so the grinding, when you're having to grind up a climb, right? So your movement of the tempo of your cadence, right? Sometimes you're super fast. Sometimes it's slow and grinding. Sometimes you're not moving at all, but you're creating a lot of tension. And so you can, by looking at that, we can create better programs that'll get us better results, and also that are more sustainable, because again, the leverage based and the slower speed stuff, doing isometric training, it's very hard to hurt yourself doing isometrics. Like I don't want you to take that as a challenge. Obviously people can do it, but it's like, if you're going to do an isometric deadlift and you're going to do a regular barbell deadlift, and then you are going to put money on which one of those someone's going to get hurt first doing, you're going to put it on the barbell deadlift. Like the movement-based exercise is always going to carry a higher risk of injury. And so if you can train the body with a lower risk of injury, then that's ideal. And so again, using isometric and slower speed stuff, it trains these tension skills that we need to apply them to the movements. And so a lot of the dynamic movement-based training that we see, again, I was touching on it earlier, right? Like box jumps, that is a dynamic movement-based exercise. Olympic lifts, squats and benches and deadlifts, these are all dynamic movement-based exercises. And so there's a very heavy emphasis in training programs towards these types of exercises. And you see very little in the way of leverage-based loading, very little in the way of intentional isometric and slow speed training, but these things have to be there. And so you get an unbalanced program, an unbalanced system, and you're also not addressing things that we need as mountain bikers, and you're using training tactics that actually carry the highest risk of injury. Dynamic, compression-based exercises carry the highest risk of injury, you know, on average, right? Like there are exceptions to that, but just in general, you're going to find that the dynamic compression-based version of a movement is going to also carry the higher risks of injury. And so the, you know, we have these programs that are focused on these things. No wonder we're getting hurt so often. And so, and we also need to move away from it. We need to round out those quadrants. We need to train these other qualities. We need to get away from those things from time to time. So it's not just the dynamic compression-based exercises. It's the over-reliance on them that leads to the problems, that lead to the injuries and stuff like that. So this four quadrants of tension concept really helps you understand how we can create better, more sustainable training programs for us while also actually addressing our needs as riders in a more specific fashion. Now, again, though, this is, you know, the whole four quadrants of tension training, this is something that you're not really going to find anywhere else. Like, I don't know why more people haven't realized this and seen this, how it's not, because again, we're all about movement patterns, you know, squat, bench, push, pull, and that's great, right? That's good functional training. But if you're not also taking into account the movement speed and the type of leverage you're putting on the system, you're just, you know, giant holes can occur and problems can occur. And so anyways, that's why, excuse me, a lot of the stuff that I've been talking about lately falls in that, things like steel mace training, isometric training, how to use them effectively and combine them effectively, things like that. So, but anyway, so that four quadrants of tension concept is kind of at the heart of the sustainable fitness training, and understanding that and how to apply that to your training is really one of the things that I want to explore more and help riders understand more as I move forward with the riding for a lifetime concept. Now, the second pillar of this concept, the riding for a lifetime concept, is sustainable riding strategies. And with this, I basically mean that just, I don't even know where to start, right? Like, again, it goes back to like the message that you get from the media. Sustainable riding strategies for most riders are going to consist of knowing how to focus on your trail rides. Your trail rides are the best cardio training you can do. One of the big mistakes that a lot of riders do is they look at their cardio training and their riding as two different things. And so they're riding and they're doing extra cardio training, which is not ideal. That is not going to be sustainable. So again, if you look at the pros, like, they're doing a different thing. They're trying to push their bodies to a limit that they need to perform at a high level, but also knowing that there's going to be long-term ramifications for this. So you can't do a lot of riding and a lot of cardio training, because your body doesn't care, right? Like, riding is cardio training. It is the best, most specific cardio training that you can do. Like, that is sport specific training. Anything that's not on your mountain bike is not technically sport specific training. And so that is the most important time that you have, is the time that you are on your mountain bike. And so you should not be taking away from that. Like, so again, a big mistake that riders make is following a program that has them on a trainer or on a road bike doing, you know, cardio stuff. And again, this is not, you know, specific to your sport. You should be focused on riding your bike. And so there's so many levels to this. Like, I'll do more on this, some podcasts and things going into this in more depth. But you know, just kind of the top layer that I want to talk about is the two things. One, the pedaling position and intensity quadrant. I love quadrants. And then also the, you know, hard, medium, and light rides, and understanding what they are and how to cycle them. And so one of the most important things that you can do for sustainable riding is to understand how to properly use standing and seated pedaling. And this is one of the most misunderstood things in the cycling world. And that is because there's just, like I said, it's a misunderstood thing. And so you're told to sit and try to spin a high RPM. That's the strategy. And that is not a sustainable strategy. Okay, that is going to lead to problems over the long term. That is a terrible thing to do to your body. Like, sitting and spinning, like, if sitting is the new smoking, then that is like doing bong hits of crack. Okay, so sitting and spinning for long periods of time, just locked in the adult fetal position, trying to spin your feet at a high RPM, is a, you know, it's not good. It's bad for your body for several reasons. When you're sitting down, your core is not as engaged. You're leaned over, so you got your posture is not good. When you're sitting down, you're not getting as full hip extension. You're not able to get full knee extension, which isn't good for your knees. When you're spinning high RPMs, you don't have much foot pressure. Without foot pressure, you're not getting the feedback your foot needs for stability and force production. And so there's just so many bad things. And again, if you're a professional rider and this is what you do to win the Tour de France and millions of dollars and all this other stuff, like, great, fine, man. But this is why those guys are hurting. Like, so few of them ride bikes, right? Like, as they get older, because it hurts, right? Like, that strategy hurts and it leads to long-term problems. And so the better way to go about it, like I said, is to understand that when you're on your bike, you're going to be in one of four basic quadrants. If you look at your pedaling position and you look at your intensity level, then you got four quadrants, right? So pedaling position, you're either standing or you're seated, right? If your butt's on the seat, then you're sitting down. If your butt's off the seat, you're standing up. That's pretty cut and dry, all right? Any contact with your seat is seated. If your butt is off the seat, you're standing up. The intensity is low tension and high tension. Again, if you think of like sitting and just like you're cruising along a flat grade, nice and easy, you know, it doesn't take much tension in your core and your system to keep the pedals turning over. That's a low tension effort, right? Now think about the opposite of that, which is trying to climb up a technical climb, a steep technical climb, where it takes a lot of tension to lock your core down, to keep the pedals turning over. Usually it's a low, you know, you're forced into a low RPM, high torque pedal stroke, as opposed to a high power, you know, low tension pedal stroke. And so this higher tension level, right? So if you think about it, like, you know, there's a spectrum there. And somewhere along the lines, you switch into what I dubbed high tension mode, and you get into high tension cardio. Not all cardio is the same. Low tension cardio is different than high tension cardio. When your cardiovascular system is working to fuel a high level of tension, that is a different thing than when it is working to fuel a low level of tension. And so, all your efforts on your bike are going to fall somewhere in there, right? So there's ways, like the fitter you are, like the further you can push, like where you start to go into high tension, you know, a lighter bike, a better bike can also make you more things more efficient. And so it also can push that. So there's all sorts of things you can do to influence where exactly that line is, where you switch from low tension to high tension efforts. But it's there. It's there for every rider in every situation. There's a line that differentiates low tension and high tension efforts. Now, the goal is to, when you switch into high tension mode, is to stand up. All right. So again, if we look at this at the quadrant, and again, I think I have a post on this, the four pedaling quadrants, I think is what I had it called. But when you look at this quadrant, you've got standing high tension and standing low tension. And then you have seated high tension and seated low tension. Now, each one of these quadrants is going to have a plus and a minus, right? Like you want to, knowing how to use them effectively for the right situation is the key to sustainable riding. Because if you don't understand this, you're going to break your body down, you're going to tear yourself up, and you're just going to suffer from all sorts of problems because you're over-relying on one or two of the quadrants as opposed to using all of them effectively. Now, when we're looking at seated, we'll start there. Seated pedaling is good for one thing, and that is seated low tension efforts, and you use that for recovery. That is to catch your breath, to recover, you know, to get ready for your next high tension effort, okay? Your high tension seated pedaling, you want to try to avoid like the plague. That is the worst thing you can do to yourself. You do not want to be in the adult fetal position trying to spin when you are in a high tension effort, laying all that tension on the system, in the muscles, through the joints, all of that. When you are in that compromised position, is one of the worst things that you can do to your body. And so avoid the high tension seated pedaling like the plague, and you'll do so much better with your long-term with the ride and your short-term performance as well. You're going to ride much better because you're going to get away from this reliance on seated pedaling. Now, there's this misunderstanding that people have about the need to sit down on their seat in order to create traction, right? We're told that, especially for climbing, that if you stand up, that you need weight on your seat and your back end in order to keep traction. Now, this is not true, right? Again, this is another subject that I'll go into more detail, but here's the thing. If weight was the most important thing, if you needed weight, and the more weight you had, the more traction you had, then like large riders would never spin out. Large riders would have infinite traction and they could climb up anything. But we know that's not the case. In fact, you get too big and you actually start to have trouble keeping traction. You start to spin out even easier, because here's the thing, for traction, what you need is not weight, you need pressure. It's pressure through the back tire into the ground that creates the traction. And weight is related to pressure, but it's not the same thing, right? So if you stand on a scale, and it, like for me, it, you know, weighs 165 pounds, I weigh 165 pounds, and then I do the, like, where I press down through my feet. I get heavy and I press, right? I don't jump. I don't actually come off the scale, but like I do the thing where I get light and then I push down into the scale with my feet, hard with my feet. And you see the scale move. You see the weight moves up and down and changes. Now, why is that, right? Like, my weight didn't change. I'm still 165 pounds, but I was able to input more and less than 165 pounds into the scale through my feet. That's pressure. Pressure is weight used actively. And again, this is a very, very important concept to understand, because if what you're trying to do is solve a weight problem, you can miss the answer. Because if the answer is a pressure problem, then you may put too much weight on it, right? So it's a weight to pressure ratio that you're looking for. And so like you can put too much weight and cause problems. Another good example is if you get a truck stuck in the sand. Okay, so you start to get people in the back and get it heavy to see if you can get it out. And so if it's not getting out, what do? Do you put more people in the back? No, you have the people start jumping, right? They start bouncing up and down. They're getting light and then putting pressure. So again, the weight of the truck hasn't changed, but the pressure that the people are creating by bouncing up and down is changing the pressure and the pressure to weight ratio, which gets the traction going. If the answer was weight, if weight was what you needed for traction, you would just keep piling people and weight into the back. But weight creates its own problems. Eventually you have so much weight that it's spinning out because you have too much weight. So this idea that you need weight on the back end is not entirely true, and it's pressure that you need. But if you think you need weight on your back end or weight on your seat in order to keep traction, then it leads to this false idea that you have to sit down all the time, especially when you're climbing, and climbing tends to be some of the highest tension efforts that we use on the trail. And so, but it's false. It's not true. All right. Again, you don't need weight. You need pressure, and you can apply pressure while standing up. Okay. You can create pressure very effectively into the rear tire while you are standing up. And that's why you see people who can stand up and climb things that, you know, again, if you needed weight and standing up made it impossible to climb things, then no one should ever be able to climb these difficult things standing up. But you see it, right? You probably experienced it yourself, but again, falling back on this, well, I got to stay seated because if I take my butt off the seat, I'm going to lose weight and I'm going to spin out. It keeps you trapped. It keeps your butt trapped on the seat. It keeps you trapped in these quadrants, the seated pedaling quadrants, and you're not able to make use of the best quadrants, which are the standing pedaling quadrants, or standing position quadrants. And so again, this is why you want to avoid sitting down for high tension efforts. And again, why you don't need it, because you can stand up and apply pressure through the rear end just fine. It takes some skill and practice to do it, but you can do it. And so your other side of the quadrant is your standing efforts. And so standing high tension, this is where this is high performance mode. Like when you are high tension downhilling, like this is why downhillers stand up. Well, one is they're more maneuverable, right? But that's what you want. You want that maneuverability when you're in these high tension modes. But you want it for high tension downhilling, high tension climbing, high tension sprints. Anytime you're in high tension mode, you want your butt off the seat, because that is the best, most natural position for your body to be in. When you're using your hands and your feet for pressure and not your crotch, okay, that's how your body is designed to work. Your hips are moving around and you're getting better hip extension. You're getting full knee extension. You're able to get yourself upright, so you're not looking up as much. Your neck is in a more natural position. It's just your body is in such a better position when you are standing up. And I'm not talking about that standing up tall all the way. You can be standing up even with your butt sitting back, right? Like, you can sink your butt back and down while standing up. You have to lower your seat to do that. But you can do that. So it's not just standing up tall. It's moving your hips around the cockpit to put your weight where you need it to create the pressure that you need for traction. But again, if your butt's on the seat and it's stuck in one position, you can't actually move your hips to get into the optimal position for that weight to pressure transfer that you're looking for. They're stuck. And so it's a much more efficient position for you to move from for so many different reasons. And then your standing low tension effort, like, this is what I call free speed, right? Like, when you're on the trail, you're not wanting to pedal, right? It's not pedaling that you want. You want momentum. Pedaling creates and helps maintain momentum, but it's not the only way to create and maintain momentum. Being good, like having good skills so that you can get through corners efficiently, get through technical sections efficiently, that is also part of it. So if you're sitting down and you go through a little like technical rock garden, and because you're sitting down, you know, you're not able to float through it the same. And so you lose a little bit more speed, and now you got to pedal at the end of it to get up to speed. Or cornering is a good example, where people try to out fitness their way through bad cornering technique. They'll come through the corner with bad technique and then just pedal their ass off to try to make up for it coming out the other side. But juxtapose that with someone who is coming in and they've got good form, so they come out with more speed and have to pedal less to maintain and create the same momentum. And so again, it's not pedaling, it's momentum that you want. And so using, like, when you stand up, you can use your skills. You can pump the trail, you can corner better, you can just, there's so many things that you can do to maintain and actually create momentum from the trail. I had a buddy in Hawaii who called it free speed. You know, he's like, man, there's free speed all over the trail if you just know where to look for it. And I was like, yeah, there is, man. Like, if you know where to you know, pump things and come out of a corner and get a little like extra pump coming out of that, and you know, just get a little little manual up and over a rock, you know, nothing spectacular, but just if you're sitting down and you hit that rock, versus like standing up and giving it a little like front and rear wheel lift to get over it. Well, you don't have to pedal. Like, you may actually catch a little momentum on the backside of that hop versus like going over the rock and then you got to keep pedaling hard, right? So pedaling is not the only way to create momentum, but it is if you're sitting down. If you're sitting down, pedaling is the primary way to create and maintain momentum. But when you stand up, you start to you tap into standing, or you tap into not only pedaling, but also your movement on the bike as a way to help you create and maintain momentum. So that's why it's even good to use standing pedaling even in low tension situations. Like, just because you're in low tension doesn't mean you just want to sit and spin. Like, if there's any sort of technical thing going on, standing up and using your technique to get through it is better than sitting down and pedaling through it. So again, from a sustainability standpoint, again, you can point to what the pros do. You can point to what the studies show. You can point to whatever you want. And that's fine. I'm not going to argue that with you, right? I'm just telling you that based on movement principles, based on my experience, based on the riders that I've helped with this concept, that this is how you make riding sustainable. That sitting and spinning is not a sustainable riding strategy. That you have to learn how to tap into standing pedaling and use the four quadrants that I've explained effectively in the appropriate, at the appropriate time, if you want to keep your body healthy and from breaking down and creating problems down the road that could keep you from performing well and potentially having to stop riding. So, like, understanding this concept is the key. Understanding and applying this concept is the key to sustainable riding. All right, guys? So don't get stuck with this sit and spin crap. Like, the cycling industry is killing you with this. It's terrible advice. So get away from it. Stand up more. Look at how kids ride their bikes, man. Right? If it's high tension mode, when you're on a BMX bike and you got the seat slammed, like if you're just cruising down the street to your buddy's house, you know, sitting down's fine. Nobody's knees are going to blow out because you're sitting and spinning with your seat down with no tension at the pedals. Your knees start to blow out if you try to put tension through your knees in that position. So, but that's when they stand up, right? You watch a kid and they got to pedal hard. They stand up and they sit down to pedal easy. And they stand up to pedal hard. And they sit down to pedal easy, right? You know how to do this. It wasn't until you grew up, right? That thing that you did as a kid, you had no problem with. You know, you rode flat pedals, you stood up and pedaled, you know, you had a great time, no problems. And then you grow up as an adult, and then some other adult comes up to you and says, hey, you know that thing that you did as a kid and you had no problem with and it never caused you any problems? You're doing it all wrong. Okay? Let me tell you how to do it. What you need to be doing is sitting and spinning. Don't stand up. Standing up is the Antichrist. If you stand up, your rear wheel's going to spin out. You're going to be burning energy like so fast that you're going to like, man, it's not even worth it. So it's not efficient and you're going to lose traction. So you better sit and spin all the time, right? So adults know how to take the fun out of and ruin everything. Don't listen to adults, all right? Like, check. Kids usually have some good strategies for when it comes to playing. And trust me, riding a bike is playing, people. Like, we're not, this isn't rocket science here, right? It's not heart surgery. We're riding mountain bikes and having fun. And that's probably another thing, right? I had somebody ask me, this is another tip. If you want to make riding sustainable, focus on having fun. You know, forget about Strava. Forget about, you know, riding for how long you're riding and how many miles you're riding. Like, just worry about how much fun you're having. Don't track that crap. Who cares? Okay. It doesn't matter. You're going to drive yourself nuts over the long term if you're just constantly looking at like how long you're riding and how fast you're riding and all these numbers. And it's like, dude, guess what? I hate to tell you this. The numbers are going to drop off. Like, as you get older, the numbers are going to drop off. And if numbers are your life, it's going to be depressing, right? But you know what doesn't drop off? And you know what actually gets better? Fun. Having fun. Like, riding gets more fun. Like, as you get better at riding, it gets more fun. Because again, you get more efficient at it. You're better at it. It gets more fun if you let it be more fun. But if your focus is these external numbers and your placings on Strava and some stupid enduro series coming up, like, it's not going to be fun. You're going to get frustrated. And so again, like, those things have a place. It's fine. Focus on them for a short period of time, but don't make them your world. Right? Like you should be focused on how much fun you're having. And that's the number one, that is, you know, my number one piece of advice there. But the last thing is also understanding the intensity. Like, going out and just riding hard all the time is not a training strategy. Well, I guess it is. It's just a bad training strategy. But what you want to be doing is cycling hard, moderate, and light rides. And this doesn't mean going out and using like heart rate monitors and power meters, because again, this is a disconnect, right? Like, when people race, when they go out and ride, you know, do their thing, like, they're not watching those things. So why are you watching those things when you're training? Like, they don't use those things to tell you how you're performing. Use your rate of perceived exertion. How do you feel? Your RPE should correlate to these things, but those things shouldn't drive everything. Your RPE should drive it, right? So just because you're going out and you're going like hard, moderate, and light rides doesn't mean you're taking the fun out of your ride. I just said you want to have fun. But, you know, a hard ride is one where you're like going out and you're pushing it. Like, you're, you know, going hard, pedaling hard, you know, really trying to, I don't know, go fast. Like, that's your day. You're like, man, I want to go fast today. I'm feeling it. I want some. You know, a moderate ride is where you're going out. And I call it, how fast can I go while pedaling the least? Right? So it's all about just, I don't want to get my RPE over a sustained like 8 or 9. Like, I want it at an 8 or lower. And so again, this isn't the day to go out and try and set a Strava PR. This isn't the day to ride like the hardest trail in the area. Like, this is the day to go out and just, maybe you have a skill thing that you're focused on. Maybe you're just going out to enjoy the ride, but you're going out for a moderate ride. You're purposefully keeping your intensity level below that 9 and 10 level. Again, for sustained periods, right? Like, you have a trail where there's a short little, you know, pitch, you got to get into that 9 or 10 zone for, you know, 5 seconds. That's fine. That's not what I'm talking about. It's like the overall rating of the ride. Like, at the end of the ride, how would you rate it, right? Like, you know, a 9 or a 10 is a ride that you would not want to come back and do the next day, right? Like a 6 to an 8, a moderate ride, is one that you could come back and you could do the next day. That's sustainable, right? A 9 and 10 is not a sustainable riding level. And so thinking you're trying to go out and ride at a 9 or a 10 every time, it's not sustainable, right? Like, you want that 6 to 8 range, punching the clock, right? So the easy rides or easy efforts, like personally for easy stuff, I recommend people get off your bike and go and walk, you know, do some running. Like, that's very important for us. Like, we're made to run and walk. And so if you're not doing that and all you're doing is cycling, like, cycling's great. I love it. It's fun. But it's not the same thing as running and walking. And it has some issues that don't cover the same things that running and walking do. And so adding those in, and so going out for a light where it's an easy walk, easy jog, right? That's good. You need those things. And now the vast majority of your rides and your training efforts are going to be that 8, like that 6 to 8, that moderate, like just punching the clock. And that's what it needs to be. Like, most people have one hard effort in them a week. I hate to break this to you guys. I have worked with, like I said, countless riders, man, just hundreds and hundreds of riders, like, you know, coaching them, thousands of them if you count, like, the questions and stuff that I've answered through the internet. I've worked with professional riders in, you know, downhill, cross country, dual slalom, like, you know, all the different disciplines. And so I've seen it. I know what I'm talking about. And that is that, I hate to break it to you, but you have maybe one hard effort a week. As you get older, you may have one hard effort like every 10 days to 2 weeks. Like, that's the reality. Like, a hard effort takes a lot out of you. And so you have to recover from that. And that gets harder to do as you age. But like, if you're a professional rider and all you have to do is train and recover, you might be able to do 2 hard training sessions a week. But the rest of your training sessions are going to be moderate and light. And again, this is that thing that I was talking about earlier that the cycling media and the fitness media completely miss out on, is that these riders, that is the truth. That is the truth, is that the bulk of what they are doing are just punch the clock, boring workouts, right? They're not spectacular. They're not great. They're not horrible. They just go in, they put in the time, they put in the effort, and they get out, okay? And that makes up the bulk of their training. But that's not sexy, that doesn't show on Instagram well, and so that's not what you see and what you hear. But that is the core of it, man. Even the riding, the bulk of it is those punch the clock, moderate workouts. And so you need to be following the same thing, which is embracing the fact that you have a limited number of hard efforts. You cannot recover from an infinite amount of work. So you have to cycle these things. And so making sure that you're looking at like your one hard ride and the rest are moderate and easy rides, and knowing how to cycle those things is another key to sustainable riding strategies. So that does it for that. And then lastly is efficient movement on and off the bike. And in a nutshell, what this means is understanding how your feet, hips and shoulders should be moving acting within a movement, and then applying those good movement principles both on and off the bike. And so, you know, when I'm watching someone work out, I'm watching someone do an exercise, or even on their bike, I'm watching their bike, I watch 3 things. I watch their feet, I watch their hips, and I watch their shoulders. And you can tell everything that's going on from what's happening there. You don't have to watch their whole body. Right? So I watch their feet to make sure that they're applying good pressure through their feet. So that means the ball of the foot, the outside edge of the foot, and the heel. You don't want to see any of those 3 points peeling up completely off the ground. Right? So good pressure through the feet, hips. I want to make sure that you are creating movement through the glutes and the hamstrings and not through the lower back. Okay, so watching how someone's moving and where's the movement coming from? Is it coming from their lower back? Is it coming from the glutes? You know, what's going on there? And then the shoulders, again, good shoulder position. You know, are the shoulder blades, are the shoulders rounded? Are they hunched up? Are they pulled back and down in a good position? Does this change as they move? And so these 3 things are going to tell me how someone is moving both on and off the bike. And so learning how to move efficiently it does two things. One, it does improve your performance. One of the things, the dirty little secrets again, that the media just does not like to talk about, but like your VO2 max is not directly correlated or directly caused. Your VO2 max does not correlate directly with your performance. Okay, so a high VO2 max gives you a better chance, you know, the higher odds of being able to be a high performer, but they're not directly related. And one of the reasons that this is because as older endurance or as endurance athletes age, what you will find is that their VO2 max actually declines while their performance improves. Okay, so again, if VO2 max was the most important thing, then if VO2 max started to decrease, their performance would decrease. But you don't see this. So there's something else that's most important, right? There's something else that's going on there. And what it is movement efficiency. Again, as these athletes have been doing their sports for longer and longer and longer, they become more and more and more and more efficient with their movements. And so they use less energy. It's easier to create power. And so they, even though their VO2 max drops off, their efficiency with their movements has gotten so good that their performance has continued to improve. And so your movement efficiency is the most important factor when it comes to your performance. And your movement efficiency is also the most important factor when it comes to sustainability, because efficient movement is sustainable movement. It means that you are moving from the right areas, you are stabilizing with the right areas. You know, all of these things are synced up in the most efficient way possible, and that's going to put the least amount of wear and tear on your joints, and it's just the easiest to sustain. So efficient movement has to be at the heart of what you're doing. So, you know, again, like this is why, you know, in the gym, I won't let someone start to use their lower back to lift more weight doing a deadlift. Okay, because I don't care if you lift more weight. Like, you know, there's a correlation between having more deadlift strength and being a better athlete in general. You know, again, I don't ask me to point out the studies. There's studies that have shown a correlation between strength and athletic performance. And so what happens there is that people get confused and they think that strength is the cause of the athletic performance. And so if you look at it and you see that top performers have a double body weight squat or a 2.5 times body weight deadlift, or they can do X lift at this level, well, then you start focusing on lifting at that level and you start trying to lift that weight rather than understanding that those athletes didn't train to lift that weight. They trained to move efficiently. And that weight was a byproduct of years of training to move efficiently. And so that's a different thing. And so getting someone who's like, man, I want to be a better mountain biker, and you know, having a stronger deadlift is going to help me be a better mountain biker. And so he gets in the gym and he starts working out and he starts letting the foot pressure go a little bit. He starts letting the shoulder position go a little bit. He starts letting his, you know, the low back position go a little bit, all in the name of trying to lift more weight in the short term. So he gets to where he can lift the weight that he had targeted, but he's actually moving less efficiently. He's picked up bad movement habits along the way. That's not a plus for you as a mountain biker. That's not what we want as athletes and as riders. And so that's why your movement efficiency has to be the primary thing. And so again, I've talked before, like this is one of the reasons that, you know, strength training is, I struggle with that term, because strength should be a byproduct of efficient movement. It shouldn't be the goal. And so again, like understanding that difference is super, super, super important for you, but also understanding how to apply these good movement principles to the bike. And this goes for, you know, the skills and the pedal stroke, but there's a huge, huge, huge disconnect between good movement principles that are pretty well understood in other sports and training off of the bike and what we're told to do on the bike. And those, that disconnect there causes a lot of problems. Again, it's not sustainable, right? So if you get on your bike and you are getting put into a position and you're being told to do things that go against good, efficient movement principles, it's not going to be sustainable. Over a long period of time, you're going to start running into problems. So again, like a good example of this is a handlebar width. This is something that I've talked about and written about extensively over the last few months. But having your handlebars too wide causes a lot of problems. And the problem, and it stems from having your hands too wide, does not allow for good, efficient upper body movement. So if you were doing push-ups and you had your hands out wide, you're not able to do push-ups properly. A trainer, a good trainer, would get you to put your hands in the proper position. And there's a sweet spot, right? Like your hands are in too narrow, you know, it's not as good. They're out too wide, it's not as good. There's a sweet spot where your hands are going to be, you know, in the position for your upper body to move most efficiently. And so you want to focus on finding that. Now, if your hands get out too wide and it starts to flare the elbows out, you start to lose pressure at the hands and the palms the way that you need it. It starts to get your shoulder blades and shoulders starting to flare up and round up. These cause problems, right? Both short-term and your ability to stabilize on the bike, but also long-term because, man, spending years and years and years with your hands and your elbows and your shoulders in this compromised position, your wrists as well, like all of these, this will add up. Like you will start to get overuse injuries and problems in these areas from having your hands too wide. It's also with the feet, right? If your feet are in a bad position, if you're too much on the balls of your feet and you're not getting pressure through your heel as well, that causes problems. And so understanding how to move well both off the bike and on the bike is super important. And again, a lot of what the skills training industry teaches you puts you in a non-sustainable position. Being on the balls of your feet with your hands out too wide is a bad, unbalanced position that does not allow you to move properly. And so you're going to develop problems from that. But again, it's a disconnect between good movement principles off the bike and then how do you apply them on the bike, as opposed to a misunderstanding of movement principles and then just a bastardization of things as people try to justify why they're telling people to do stuff. But anyways, understanding how to apply good, efficient movement principles on and off the bike is, again, that third pillar. So those three things taken together, right? Sustainable fitness training. You need fitness training because you need mobility training, you need strength training. These things are going to help you fight back the effects of aging in general, right? Not just necessarily for mountain biking specifically, but just in general. You will lose mobility, you will lose strength, you will lose muscle mass as you get older, and these things will affect you. And so if you don't do things, you don't have strategies that help you address that and proactively work towards minimizing those losses as you get older, then it's, again, that's not sustainable. So you have to have some sort of fitness training strategy that both helps support that and helps support your riding in a sustainable way. You also need sustainable riding strategies. And like we talked about, you're understanding how to use standing and seated pedaling properly, understanding to focus on fun, how to use hard, moderate, and light rides properly. And then finally, the third one is your efficient movement. And because efficient movement is the key to long-term performance enhancements and also keeping you injury-free through the long term as well. And so, you know, keeping that eye on efficient movement and not compromising that efficient movement is an important thing as well. And again, you can point to what the pros do. You can point to all this other stuff. I don't care. I'm not talking about what they do. I'm talking about what you need to do this for a lifetime. And if that's your goal, then the things that I'm talking about here need to be something that you're considering and putting into practice, or else you're going to run into problems if you're not already running into those problems now. So again, to close things up here, I want to say that performance enhancement and sustainability can't both be most important. You have to choose one. And my goal with the Riding for a Lifetime concepts and the camps, the workshops, the programs, and other things I'm going to be creating based on it is to help riders understand the best ways to prioritize sustainable practices that'll keep them riding strong tomorrow and for years to come. So again, you can enhance your performance and maintain a sustainable riding and training strategies, but you just have to know how to do it. And like I said, unfortunately, that's not the general message that you get. You don't really find this in a whole lot of places, because it's not what's sexy, it's not what sells, it's not what the pros are doing. But again, if that's what you're into, there's plenty of media cycling outlets there for you to get that stuff. But if you're looking for ways to do this, like I said, better tomorrow and for years to come, then I'm looking forward to sharing a lot of stuff based on this moving forward, and really excited about this. Like I said, this does represent a new direction for Bike James, and it's been a direction I've been moving for quite a while. I mean, even before this, you know, I realized a long time ago that the average rider had much different goals and needs and wants than pro riders did. But the industry focuses on pros, and they're almost like disconnected from what the average rider thinks. It's really kind of funny, like, to talk to people in the industry and hear what they think the average rider wants and doesn't mind dealing with and all this other stuff. And it's just like, man, you guys are so clueless. Like, you're in your little like bubbles over there dealing with your sponsored riders and the people that you're giving stuff to for free and your race teams. And you think this is everything. You think this is the cycling world. Well, meanwhile, you know, we're out here sitting around the campfire talking about totally different things. Like, we have totally different strategies. You know, like, most of us don't care who wins the Enduro World Series or the, you know, cross country or downhill World Cup. Like, we don't care who the top, we don't care about like what any of this stuff is. What we care about is having fun and feeling like we're getting better, right? We do want to feel like we're getting better as we're riding, but we want to have fun and we want to be able to do this over the long term. And so that goal is just so much different than what the cycling industry in general portrays, just because they're so disconnected from you guys and what you guys really want and really need. And they just keep trying to tell you that this is what you want and need without realizing that that's not it. And it's actually causing harm and problems for you guys. So anyways, I'm hoping that this will give you guys a resource there to start, you know, fighting back against that. But again, you guys can learn more at bikejames.com. Like I said, I've got some camps that I'll be doing. My first one I'm doing in a couple months, in May. Yeah, in May. And then I'm planning on doing another one in September, and be doing some workshops and all sorts of stuff coming from this. So like I said, if you're not able to make the camps, don't worry. I am going to be sharing a lot more info and a lot more stuff to help you guys with riding for a lifetime, because really that is most of our goal. It's not getting a KOM on Strava. It's making sure that I can do this and also do it in a way that's going to let me enjoy the rest of my life as well, right? Like, so you ride well, but you get off the bike and your back hurts and everything hurts and you can't really do anything else. Like, that's no fun either. So, you know, how do we do this? How do we do this in the long term? And so that's what we're going to be working on together here, guys. So anyways, hopefully you guys have enjoyed this podcast and the tips in it. If you got any questions or comments, you can leave them at the post that'll be at bikejames.com with this on it, or you can email me at bikejames.com. I'm always happy to help, and I will talk to everybody next time.